In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear Professor Ken DeFeis as he delivers the Lauritzen Memorial Lecture at the California Institute of Technology on December 1st of 2005. The talk was titled, The Peak of World Oil Production, Thanksgiving Day 2005. We join Professor Tom Tombrello as he introduces Ken DeFeis.
Tonight we're going to have a talk from a geologist's perspective, and that is Professor Ken DeFeis, Professor Emeritus at Princeton University. The title of the talk is The Peak of World Oil Production, Thanksgiving Day 2005. Well, I'm sorry, I'm off by a week, but you probably wouldn't have come on Thanksgiving evening. Professor DeFeis you probably first met him as a character in John McPhee's book. He is the geologist that takes John McPhee around in Basin and Range and Assembling California. He appears again writing his own books, and you can see the point there, which is Hubbard's Peak. King Hubbard was a scientist at Shell Development Lab in Bel Air, Texas, and he made a prediction, and you'll hear a lot about this prediction tonight, as you did in David Goodstein's talk a year ago. I'm a physicist, and I'm a teacher. If you didn't get the message a year ago, I brought another speaker in to make sure you get the message. I'm making you an offer you can't refuse. The interesting thing for me is, of course, in 1958, Ken DeFeis went to Shell Bel Air, but there I was, having just graduated from Rice, as a young sort of technical assistant in one of the labs at that same place. And so this was truly a magical time that there was a bunch of brilliant young people like Ken DeFeis and Peter Weil. There were older people like Gus Archie, who I could not appreciate at the time. But then I went to work for a company as a vice president that probably made $1 billion a year on something called Archie's Equation. And then, of course, there was Ken Hubbard. And you're going to hear about Ken Hubbard and the extensions of what he did tonight. So without any more talk from me, Ken DeFeis.
I appreciate the invitation to visit Caltech. I've met friends that I've known for almost 50 years, like Jerry Wasserberg, and had dinner with Blacker College or Blacker House, which was where my brother had been a student as a chemical engineer here in the 1950s. All right, this first slide is how you make an author feel bad. This is my 40,000 word book shrunk onto a coffee mug. But it's essentially the message that the peak of world oil production is happening right now, and I'll try to convince you that right now means literally. It wasn't Thanksgiving Day exactly, it's Thanksgiving Day plus or minus 3 weeks, as the time when world oil production peaks. Now, my first book in 2001 contained this diagram repeated from M. King Hubbard's 1956 paper, and I've added the black dots to show what actually happened. And in 1956, Hubbard predicted that United States oil production, the upper curve there, would peak sometime in the early 1970s. And the little dots show that 1970 itself was the peak year, and about 1975, Prudhoe Bay starts to kick in. But Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, as the biggest oil field ever found in the United States, wasn't big enough to bring us back up to the year 1970 peak. Now, we knew this was correct. Those dots could have staggered on upwards. But in 1972, the Texas Railroad Commission announced 100% allowable for the next month. And there was a little tiny story in the newspaper, you know, that said this. But, of course, if you knew how to translate it, it meant we're out of unused production capacity in the United States. We're dependent on imports. And I went home and told my family, old Hubbard was right. We're in the soup now. The U.S. has no unused production capacity. The second book goes on because Hubbard in 1982, when he was 79 years old, at the stage I now call mid-career, he... published a long paper, 150 pages, describing his methods. And before it was kind of take it or leave it. He'd give you the answer, and you had to try to figure out whether he had a legitimate way of getting there. But in this last long paper that he wrote, he used this kind of graph, and typical of Hubbard, he didn't tell you that population biologists had been using it for 10 years before that. On the vertical axis is the annual production divided by the cumulative production. And on the horizontal axis is the cumulative production. Q in this racket stands for cumulative. And after 1958, the U.S. oil production settles down to a pretty good straight line. Now, I'm using the U.S. not out of patriotism, but because the U.S. is the most explored area in the world. Someday, Iran will look like Kansas, with dry holes so close together you can't put another major oil field in between them. Well, since it settles down to a pretty good straight line, with your permission, my computer and I draw the best-fitting straight line. And while I was working on this, I discovered that Hubbard's derivation, which was two or three pages of heavy differential equations, if instead of going from A to B, I went from B to A, and I could do it in three lines of high school algebra. Now, I apologize, being a Caltech audience, I should have just put up the original differential equations, and you could all nod wisely, and see, we'd go on. But here's the thing reduced to three lines of high school algebra. And I'm not very good at math, so I was delighted to find an easy way out. The top equation is just the equation of a straight line. The second equation, I go in and substitute what's on this graph. P over Q is Y, the vertical axis. A is still named A, the intercept on the vertical axis. And the slope of the line is minus A over Q sub T. Now, Q sub T, you could put either of two meanings on. One interpretation says it's the total cumulative production when the last well runs dry. When P goes to zero, then the line hits Q sub T. The other way you can think of it is, oh, look, it's just an algebraic thing. It's a geometric thing. It's where the line hits the origin, and it doesn't really mean that's how much total oil there is. Now, the third equation, I go through and multiply both sides by Q, and that's the Hubbard theory. The heavy magic is inside the parenthesis. That's the fraction of oil that hasn't been produced yet, or if you're exploring for oil, it's the fraction of oil that hasn't been found yet. And the analogy is to catching fish in a pond. If I go to my favorite pond and I catch fish and cook the bass for supper, but after a few months, I notice I'm not catching as many fish. Now, I can go to the fishing tackle store and buy a very expensive fly rod and, you know, new technology, or I can decide, look, I've caught most of the fish. I'm going to go to the grocery store and buy fish. So the magic is inside the parenthesis, and what's not inside the parenthesis, which gripes economists no end, the price of oil is not in there. And my take is, oh yeah, the price of oil matters, but it doesn't matter very much. The oil business has been so profitable that even at $1 a barrel, you could get big Texas rich with a good oil field. The other things that follow from this equation, if it's a straight line on this graph, the downside is the mirror image of the upside. It's bilaterally symmetrical, and the little plus sign on the graph is the midpoint, which occurs when half the oil has been produced. And remember, this all follows from the simple hypothesis that the ease of finding oil depends on the fraction of oil that hasn't been found yet. Now, Hubbard took a shot at world oil production, and this is 1968 that he published this. His more optimistic estimate peaks in the year 2000, and it's 2,100 billion barrels. My latest take says, well, it's 2005, and it's 2,013 billion barrels. Now, his critics say, look, 2000 came and went, and it didn't peak. So Hubbard is wrong, you know. Well, you see, look, from 1968, this is pretty good shooting to get to within 5 years and within 5% of the right answer. So Hubbard, you know, is not accepted in that sense, but if I go on and make the same graph for world oil production, after 1983, it begins to behave like a nice straight line, and after I sent the book to the publisher, there's one more black dot for the year 2004, and it's jammed up against that plus mark, And it was on an enlarged version of that graph, where I counted out how far the years were apart, that I got the Thanksgiving Day 2005 prediction. And the uncertainty really is not very large. Now, the thing points to 2 trillion barrels, and I'll show you later a refined estimate that's 2013 trillion barrels. Now, we knew, I claim, that this was correct because this story came across the Dow Jones Newswire in early March of 2003, and Saudi Aramco and the government of Saudi Arabia told Western governments and the major oil companies that they were maxed out at 9.2 million barrels a day. And since that time, there have been 2 brief periods, 2 3-month periods, where the Saudi production went above 9 million barrels a day. Most months in the last 2 years, they've been under 9 million barrels a day. So it looks as if this is the equivalent story to the Texas Railroad Commission in 1972. Now, I carefully read my New York Times for the next 2 days. No mention of this story. So even though I'm a registered Democrat, I snuck out and bought the Wall Street Journal for 2 days. No mention. And the Wall Street Journal is Dow Jones. And here is the most important story since the Industrial Revolution. You know, Watt invents steam engine. World runs out of cheap oil. World runs out of cheap energy. And it didn't even make the newspaper. So there's a massive lack of attention being paid to this problem. Matt Simmons, who is a banker, he's head and founder of Simmons Co. International, the largest merchant bank in the oil industry. And Simmons was on a trip to Saudi Arabia. He said he almost didn't go, but finally he did. And as he's listening, he says, some of this doesn't add up. And he came home and discovered that he could download 200 technical papers that had been published over the years by Saudi Aramco engineers, and often they wouldn't even identify which oil field it was. Oh, but there are 37 wells in this field. Oh, that's the South Blankenship. You know, he sorted them out on his table into different oil fields and got help from petroleum engineers to interpret what all this meant. And he has a very recent, detailed analysis saying the Saudis are struggling to keep up. Now, this came out November 12, 2005, saying that Kuwait says the Bergan field, which is almost as big as the biggest field in Saudi Arabia, is now peaked out, and sorry, the 2 million barrels a day for the next 30 or 40 years, this isn't going to be there. They're peaking out at 1.7. So the word is going around, and even the major oil companies, you may have seen one of the Chevron ads that says, we're burning 2 barrels of oil for every barrel we find. ExxonMobil is saying that the last year when we found more oil than we burned was in the mid-1980s, and Shell Oil has announced, they're now Shell Gas, that they're going to forego the search for oil and become a natural gas search operation. They'll continue to run their tar sand mine producing oil in Canada, but they're basically kissing the oil business goodbye. So the major companies are acting as if they understand what's going on. Now, that's not universal. Here's Daniel Yergin, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, in a prediction about 6 months ago, and they took every announcement that an oil company or a national government had announced a project to do XYZ, and Jurgen's people then said, oh, well, all of these things will come in on time and under budget, and nobody will drill a dry hole, and their things plotted on my graph just suddenly take off into a faster than exponential growth. And sure, guys, nobody will drill a dry hole, and these things will all happen, you know, on time. And I don't believe it for a minute. Jurgen's not a dummy, however. He sold out CERA to IHS company and pocketed the money and ran. Now, this is the gloomiest of all of the graphs. And instead of talking about the year when the oil was produced, we're talking about the year of the first well in a field. And when you find that first well, you certainly are not going to stop drilling until you drill up the horizontal and vertical extent of the field. It's irreversible. You're not going to forget where the well was, and you're not going to forget to follow up. When I do that, the paucity of big hits lately brings me down almost to the bottom line, saying that the oil fields that we have now found contain 94% of all the oil we're ever going to find. Now, there's a lot of oil to be found by expanding existing fields, but as far as discoveries, it looks like, here's where the 2013 comes from, is the horizontal intercept here. Now, the U.S. Geological Survey in the year 2000 published an estimate of 3 trillion barrels, and they did it by inventorying the whole world, and I can give another 90-minute lecture on the troubles with the USGS thing, but I'll point out briefly, they have to make up that gap between my 2 and their 3, they have to find another Middle East. Then they have to find another North Sea on top of it. And in the case of the United States estimate, they say that there's an undiscovered oil resource the size of Kuwait beneath the United States. And of course, I tease them by saying, hey, is that in South Alabama? You know, whisper in my ear. I'll split it with you. We'll all be rich. But it just doesn't exist. But a lot of estimates have been then produced by taking the USGS number as fact and then figuring out, oh, we won't have an oil peak until 2036 or sometime like that. Now, part of my trouble in talking about this is that every editor wants his writers to be fair, and that means tell both sides of the story. Well, when you tell both sides of the story, most of the readers will look at it and say, well, the experts don't agree, so there's no knowledge on this subject, so I won't do anything, which is an automatic win for the cornucopians, the ones who believe that there's going to be this wonderful, huge supply of oil, and we won't have a problem. So the cornucopians automatically win when people are fair. And I'll tell you, my favorite television commercial was of a guy getting a shave from an old-fashioned barber with a straight razor, and when he gets down to shaving the guy's neck, a nurse in a white uniform sneaks up behind him with a pair of brass band cymbals, and just as she's poised to clash the cymbals, the line across the bottom says, "Give blood, we're tired of asking nicely." Well, my take is, I'm tired of asking nicely, that editors, I think, are one of the great enemies of the people at this time. Now, I'm not the worst pessimist in the world. I found this in the checkout line at the grocery store. So there's people on both sides of me. Now, when I put these as bell-shaped smooth curves, the production is peaking in this year. Discoveries, which Hubbert used to mean the total amount of oil produced plus the known reserves as of that date, are in between, and then hits are what we just looked at. That's first well in the field. And when I put these in the cumulative form, the amount left to be found by exploration between the hits curve and the ceiling is the last 6%. But the gap I've named after my friend and Shell Lab colleague Bob Snyder is the gap between what's been identified as reserves and what it really amounts to. And what Tom just told you about the Archie equation has been the leading thing that Bob Snyder uses. He looks back at these old well logs, because Schlumberger's been doing resistivity logs since 1920, and looking for horizons that had enough electrical resistance to maybe produce oil. And you can imagine the boss saying in 1930, oh, this is a nice high resistivity zone, we'll produce that. Ah, this might be water, forget it. You know, here's another nice high resistivity zone. And now, you know, 9 bosses later, nobody remembers that such a decision was ever made. And Snyder comes along, does the Archie equation calculation for oil saturation and says, I think that's going to flow oil. And he bought 33 oil fields in the Texas Gulf Coast and West Texas, found several hundred million barrels of additional oil at a finding cost of $2.50 a barrel. He had an after tax cash flow rate of return of 17%, and you know, glorious performance. And it's now the new buzzword is redevelopment, going back to old oil fields, not for tertiary recovery, not for enhanced recovery, not trying to squeeze the last drop out of existing formations, but whole horizons that weren't produced in the early days. So it's probably a factor of three bigger than grassroots exploration. Now, everybody wants to know about price, and this is the price of natural gas in the United States, and this is first sale downstream from the well, first time that gas is traded for dollars, and the price at the Henry Hub spot market down in Louisiana, where a bunch of pipelines come together, is like this, only the swings are even bigger. And up through about 1987, the curve is very smooth. Then you start seeing wintertime peaks, and then 3 years ago it goes crazy. And the most recent peak is twice as high as these. So what's going on? Well, the wife of one of my friends heard this lecture and she said, oh, one of your equations is upside down. Well, it was right side up the way I was using it, but she knew it from queuing theory. And she had been a systems engineer with Bell Telephone Labs for 20 years, and the phone company knows about queuing. It's the customers waiting to use the long distance circuits. But in queuing theory, she pointed out, the length of the queue, when the demands on the system approach the capacity of the system, the length of the queue becomes very volatile. And you know this from the grocery store or the bank or the airline check-in, that there's either nobody in line or a whole lot of people in line. And it's built in that if people are arriving at random, when the demands on the system approach the capacity of the system, we're going to see price volatility. And when people ask me, what's the price of oil? My first answer is, it's going to be very volatile. It's going to zoom up and down on you. And of course, managers hate uncertainty. Matt Simmons made the interesting point that up until about 20 years ago, almost all natural gas was sold under long-term contracts. But now, without anybody discussing it, the price of oil and the price of natural gas are either the spot market or the shortest futures contract. And he says, look, if you could go back to signing a long-term contract, a 20-year contract, with a buyer who has a AA credit rating, he says, I can get you the money for that project at 4%. But if you want to have this price volatility show up in the rewards for making the investment, then the investor is going to want to see 15 or 20% cash flow rate of return in order to justify the exposure to that price volatility. So with a simple piece of paper, a long-term contract, producers and purchasers could eliminate that. Now, as this gets volatile, as things get difficult, as the general prices rise, there's some services that we know we need to have. And you can see the red cross. This is an ambulance, and we don't want this to happen. But we're going to have to reconfigure things and reprioritize things to arrange for a world where things make sense again. Now, my list of industries that are going to get hit are all crowded up at the top of the alphabet. Zymergy, which happened to be at the end of the alphabet, is the industrial use of yeast to make bread and wine and cheese. But up at the top, agriculture is very much at risk because the Green Revolution of 1970 was based on better seed varieties, heavy use of mineral fertilizer, and pesticides. Well, the pesticides are almost all petrochemicals. The mineral fertilizers are very heavy users of energy, and specifically the phosphate for fertilizer comes out of the ground as rock phosphate, same mineral that your teeth and bones are made of, and a lot of energy goes into converting that to water-soluble superphosphate that the plants can get at easily. The nitrogen fertilizer, what's nitrogen from the air? Isn't it free? Yeah, what do you react it with? Hydrogen. Where do you get the hydrogen? Natural gas. Uh-oh. Alan Greenspan has been telling us for a year and a half we're maxed out on natural gas in North America. In the automotive business, there were some nice options. 20 years ago, the natural gas-powered automobile was beginning to catch on, and there were natural gas civilian filling stations in New Zealand, Italy, and British Columbia. But then when the regulations changed in the United States and you could generate electric power with natural gas, suddenly that market got maxed out, and the natural gas-powered automobile is not on the list. The brightest thing on the horizon for the automobile are these high-efficiency diesels being marketed in Europe that get more than 100 miles to the gallon, double what a gasoline electric hybrid will get you, but they're not being sold in the United States, and I don't know why, but it's worth serious look. In the case of aviation, they don't have any alternatives. They're hooked on JP4 jet fuel and hooked very tightly. And aircraft manufacturers, passenger airlines, air freight, everything is going to be in a squeeze. And half the airline seats in the United States are now in bankruptcy. My brother first pointed this out when he read the first draft of Hubbard's Peak. He said, wait a minute, aviation is really going to be in trouble. And he was muttering, you know, I know a vice president of Boeing. I'm going to send him a copy of the book. Well, then, in this last year, when Boeing started taking away contracts from Airbus because the Boeing 787 is going to have the lowest fuel consumption per seat mile of any airliner, they have been winning contracts away from Airbus. So I went back to my brother and said, hey, did you do that? And he says, oh, yeah, I don't want to take credit, but it's Caltech talk. I don't want to take credit, but I did send him a copy of the book, and I said, you better read this. You better memorize it. It's your future. So my brother and I claim we're the ones who bailed out Boeing. But the aircraft engine manufacturers are the bright spot that the efficiency, the compression ratio of these engines has gone up and up and up, and elderly 747s are flying nonstop New York to Hong Kong when they used to have to refuel, you know, in Minneapolis, Anchorage to get as far as Tokyo. Now, this is just a reminder when people say, well, what's going to happen to the price? All economists will decide that price is going to be the rationing, and the price will rise until supply again meets demand, and at that point there'll be a new steady equilibrium price. But this picture is a reminder that the Nixon administration fixed the price of oil. Now, William Safire of the New York Times writes funny cell phone interviews with Richard Nixon, who's serving a term in purgatory for fixing prices. If you're a Republican, see, that's a sin. And so what the Nixon administration invented, maybe inadvertently, was rationing by inconvenience. If you can remember the era, there were long lines of cars waiting for what little gasoline there was in the filling station. Then at an even earlier era, President Roosevelt had us running around with little red and blue ration coupons. So the answer is there will be rationing. But whether it's rationing by price, inconvenience, or coupons, or something else, we don't know. Now, I found this one on Taiwan, and I don't read Chinese, but I decided what it should say is, tell the kids to turn out the lights. The sorts of things we could do next Monday morning, a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, and they will hate me in Montana, teaching the kids to turn out the lights, opening the house windows at night when it's cool at night to avoid using air conditioning during the day. There's some things that we can do right now. Then the next category is things that we know how to do, have the engineering done, and these are things like wind generation, nuclear, the high-efficiency diesel automobiles, where the engineering is done, we just need to get with it and start building. And then there are the blue sky things. Oh, the hydrogen-powered automobile or the, you know, something or other. But we need some R&D. We need to have an Apollo project or a Manhattan project, which might or might not work, in order to supply it. Well, one of my answers is, how about some old technology? And this is the city of Paris in 1870. And what the guy is delivering from the horse-drawn wagon is a mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide. Not high on your safety list right now, but it was used for illumination and for cooking. And you can see underneath the front of the top of the wagon across the street a gas light. And this gas was made by reacting coal with a limited amount of air and a lot of steam and producing what was variously called coal gas or town gas or water gas. The equivalent reaction today was re-engineered by Texaco engineers before Texaco got absorbed into Chevron, and they used pure oxygen, higher temperatures, better catalysts, better yield, and produced a synthesis gas, because once you have that hydrogen, you could do lots of interesting things. Existing needs are petroleum refining and nitrogen fertilizer, but additional possibilities are you can make gasoline, and the Germans flew their Air Force during World War II with aviation gasoline made from soft brown coal. You can make methanol. And one of my friends has an enthusiasm for dimethyl ether. It's an almost ideal diesel fuel, and it doesn't make soot. I had to look up the formula. It's a CH3 methyl group, an oxygen, another CH3 on the other side. There are no carbon-carbon bonds in that molecule. It can't make soot. You won't get black smoke out of a dimethyl ether diesel. And it's non-toxic, and I had to go to the drugstore and check it out, that the propellant in almost all hairspray today is dimethyl ether. It's non-toxic. You can be in a little bathroom spraying this stuff. You don't pass out. The old anesthetic in the operating room was diethyl ether. And it's made from coal, and it's a pilot plant running in China at the 10,000 gallon a day level. They're selling it for both cooking fuel and hoping to get the cost down to the range of $1 to $2 a gallon and sell it as diesel. And there's interest. Here's Volvo with DME for dimethyl ether on a diesel truck. This might be the thing of the future. Now, one of the situations that's happening today is that the major oil companies are taking in tens of billions of dollars per company per quarter on profits from the high price of oil. Now, of course, the Congress is looking over their shoulder saying, how about another windfall profits tax? And Matt Simmons made the sarcastic comment, they don't have a business plan. They've got no idea what to do with those billions of dollars. They're not drilling lots of exploratory wells. They're not building new tanker ships. They're not building new pipelines. They're not building new refineries. Because in fact, look, if world oil is peaking, you don't need any more tanker ships. You don't need any more pipelines. You don't need any more refineries. So they're sitting on top of all this cash, and so my new cottage industry is writing business plans, imaginary business plans, for major oil companies. And coal gasification is the general thing for this coal gas, water gas, town gas, synthesis gas. And as I mentioned, you can make lots of different products with it. After you gasify this stuff, you have a very limited amount of gas. It's not like a great giant smokestack full of hot exhaust. It's a limited amount of gas, and you can strip out the sulfur, sell it, get paid. You can strip out the mercury if there's mercury. You can sell the carbon dioxide, and I was up in North Dakota a couple of weeks ago. They're selling carbon dioxide from reacting soft brown coal this way to the Canadian oil companies for secondary recovery of oil. It's the most successful way of squeezing the last bit of oil out of an existing oil field is to inject carbon dioxide. And instead of having the Kyoto Accord people on your neck, you're getting paid for the carbon dioxide. Now, if a major company were to take out after the dimethyl ether thing, the Air Products Company in Easton, Pennsylvania seems to have a lot of patents on producing dimethyl ether. So, hey, you got billions of dollars, buy Air Products. It's a profitable company. Buy a coal producer. You'd like to have the biggest diesel distributor in the United States, and that's Flying J Truck Stops, based in Provo, Utah. And since Matt Simmons is a native of Utah, I was going to send him in to negotiate. And if he doesn't work by New Jersey rules, I'll send in Guido and Vinny, and they'll make them an offer that they don't refuse. And look, that previous slideshow, Volvo's already pre-sold. You might want to acquire the Volvo truck business. You could put together a whole arm of a company that implements transportation, and this is a route. Another one that's fascinating is not ethanol from corn, but ethanol from corn stalks, from cellulose. And this particular U.S. patent took the jungle rot. The tents on Guadalcanal in World War II just dissolved in the jungle. And it turns out it was a fungus, Trichoderma, that was metabolizing the cellulose, the cotton in the tent canvas. And this company up in Canada is trying to pump up, produce ethanol from lawn clippings, waste, corn stalks, squeezed leftover bagasse from extracting sugarcane. And they've already got Shell and Petro-Canada behind them, so might not be easy to take that over, but it's certainly an opportunity that Shell or Petro-Canada might take to go into the ethanol from cellulose business. Another one, you know, drifting a little further away from the existing oil business, is low-energy agriculture. Now, I insist this is not organic farming. Organic farming, you know, based on organic fertilizers, there's just not that much cow plop in the world. And in fact, 3 billion people have to starve to death, probably 5 billion of the 6 billion in the world would have to starve to death if we cut back to straight organic farming. On the other hand, there are ways to use a minimum amount of fertilizer. And although we can make nitrogen fertilizer using hydrogen from coal, certainly if you can rotate crops with the legume family, alfalfa and beans, that fix their own nitrogen, it's called green manure, great. But in the case of phosphate, look, they can't. There's no source of phosphate. It doesn't come from the air. And the interesting thing there would be careful soil analyses, subdivide the big plots and, you know, try to put on just enough phosphate, use the analytical tools to get by with the minimum. And similarly with pesticides, with diagnostic tools and carefully tuned pesticides, try to use less. Now, the crop types are interesting because it's going to have to focus on products that can be grown locally, stored inexpensively. And I just got in a book on root cellars, which is an old-fashioned concept, storing carrots and potatoes. But amongst other things we're going to have to learn to love are rutabagas and parsnips and turnips, which I hate, but we're going to have to learn to do it. And Berkeley College at Yale has converted to a locally grown thing, and Alice Waters from Berkeley and her daughter have been guiding Berkeley College to a new style. And another interesting thing is if you do have energy involved in irrigation, the criticism of wind and solar is, hey, they don't happen all the time. Well, I don't care which time of day the water comes up to irrigate the field. And, you know, my grandmother had a daisy wheel windmill. We go back to using wind opportunistically to perform functions, you know, for agriculture. So I claim that, yes, the major oil companies could take on domains where energy is now used very intensively and try to re-engineer that whole end of the system. The most technological of the dreams comes from Rick Smalley, Rice University, discovered buckyballs. And after he won the Nobel Prize, he was told, well, you can teach anything you want in the university. And he thought a while and said, energy. Then he got interested in how would you do this? And was trying to develop high-efficiency direct current transmission lines, high voltage, low weight bucky tube transmission lines, and local storage. Everybody says, you can't store electricity. They said, look, you buy a refrigerator-sized gadget down in the basement that is your electric storage unit, and if at 4 in the afternoon your air conditioning goes down, hey, we'll sell you a bigger gadget to go in your basement. But it takes away some of the need to have a highly reliable grid. And we can use things where they are at their best. Solar energy, you know, Arizona, Nevada, wind energy, West Texas, standard wind gauge in Amarillo, Texas, as a blacksmith's anvil on the length of chain, and when it starts flapping around, they'll get the winds blowing. So use it where they do the best, and if he could transport electricity very cheaply, great. And in parentheses down at the bottom, I want to have the 3-volt house. The computer wants 3 volts, the LED lights want 3 volts, your new Peltier Effect refrigerator is going to want 3 volts. And so let's just rewire the house for 3 volts, and if the baby chews into the wire, hey, you won't even feel it. Now, I'm getting some help from the religious right, and they are asking themselves, look, if Jesus were alive today, would he be driving around in a little Japanese hybrid? And my son found what is the wrong answer, that I love the line up at the top, for God so loved the world that he gave us monster trucks. So that's not the way it goes. Now, part of the debate is, do we have a hard landing or a soft landing? Now, a soft landing, you need to get in place enough new nuclear power capacity, wind generation, efficiency in housing, and efficiency in automobile transportation in place by last Thursday, and we'd have a soft landing, a seamless transition. But it's very likely the longer we go, and the fact that we didn't listen to Jimmy Carter says that it's going to be a hard landing. The least vicious of the hard landings is a global recession, possibly worse than 1930. And that's, you know, on the one side, and the harder hard landing, I borrowed the four horsemen of the apocalypse: war, famine, pestilence, and death. When I was young, I was told, reading the Bible is a good thing, but don't try to read the last chapter, you'll only get confused. And the four horsemen are out of the book of Revelations, and these are their traditional names. But famine, I talked about, that agriculture is very much at risk, and pestilence, hey, these are petrochemicals, most of the pesticides. Amos Noor at Stanford, geophysicist who's been head of their geophysics section for a number of years, stood up a year ago at the American Geophysical Union meeting and all but predicted war between the United States and China. Now, he said, I don't want war between the United States and China, and I hope by predicting it, somebody will be smart enough to figure out how not to have a war between the United States and China. But his take is that the first 3 skirmishes in the oil war were the first Gulf War, the World Trade Center, the second Gulf War, the one on now. And in the case of the World Trade Center, it's been largely forgotten. Osama bin Laden's announced purpose was to displace the government of Saudi Arabia. And by taking down the World Trade Center, he showed he was the biggest, baddest Arab on the block and, you know, the logical contender to take over the government of Saudi Arabia. And either that or having Saudi Arabia descend into a civil war is just the end. It would disrupt the world so severely that a global recession is sort of built in and guaranteed. So it's a nervous, nervous time. And this last picture is of M. King Hubbard in the 1930s. And I got a letter from a long retired crystallographer who said, oh, I knew Hubbard at Columbia University in the 1930s. He was interested in the oil limit problem even then. So it turns out that very likely Hubbard was watching this thing from the depths of the Great Depression up through 1956. And finally, when the data were complete enough that he could just barely see where the top of the peak was, he pounced, published on it. He had some good luck. It could have been actually an earlier peak than the one he predicted, but he hit it, you know, right on the nose, became a folk hero. So, and this picture from the 1930s looks like he was no easier to get along with than he was later. Thank you.
We have some aisle mics to take questions for our speaker.
I'd like to ask about a scenario. Suppose that we made a major capital investment. We go out and we coat the desert with solar cells, billions, maybe even $1 trillion. They're going to wear out. There'll be a small replacement cost. But once we've done that and laid the lines, no pollution, no oil, no coal, no nuclear, just solar power.
When I was writing the second book, I had the ambition to do a solar demo. I wanted to build a 60-watt, it was going to be a hydrogen-oxygen soldering torch. And so I look up, okay, what's it going to cost for 60 watts worth of solar cells? $1,000. Well, as I watched for a while, I found a few surplus catalogs that would get it down to $800. But for a 60-watt demo, you know, and they say, well, wait a minute, how are these people showing up with garage tops? And they say, oh, we got a tax break. I said, you mean you figured out how to use my tax money to build your solar cells? And no. So we're just a long ways from a cash-on-cash return that is going to take, you know, 50 years. And we just normally don't do that, do something grossly uneconomic. And it's going to be, in the short run, much more acceptable, economic, to build nuclear power plants and use wind energy, use coal.
Okay, a lot of the ideas that you're proposing that could be put into place in the short run anyway, look to me like they're still going to have a problem that, although it extends the perhaps use of oil right now, it still creates a problem, and most of the analyses I've seen seem to say that, you know, any major things you do with existing technology or soon to be available technology will extend the availability of oil or the crash, if you will, by only a very short period of time. Then the other side to that is a lot of these I don't see where they're going to address the perhaps equally big problem of carbon sequestration or the need for that. I wonder if you have any comments on that, those areas.
The carbon problem, in the short run, until the demand for carbon dioxide for secondary recovery of petroleum is satisfied, hey, I got a market. And we've already built pipelines from southern Utah to West Texas and from southern Missouri to Louisiana to carry carbon dioxide to the oil fields. Now, at some point, you saturate that market, then you got to start thinking about other things to do. But for the 15-year, 20-year kind of run, there's a market sitting there waiting to pay for the carbon dioxide. Now, in the long run, I think what'll happen is that the last of the oil, 10% is going into petrochemicals right now. And, you know, it's the fiber in the shirt, it's the paint, it's plastics, it's, you know, a whole lot of things are petrochemicals. And probably it'll go to 20%. As oil production goes down, it'll almost all go into petrochemicals because that's the high value use of the product. And I claim our grandchildren will look at us and say, you burned it? You just burned it? And we'll have to admit, we burned it. All those lovely preformed molecules. So I suspect it will simply become the petrochemical industry towards the end.
You mentioned that you don't know why the diesel, high-efficient diesel engines aren't used in the United States. And you also mentioned the Manhattan Project and Apollo Project for possible alternative energy sources. But the issue that you raise about it not being economically feasible to transition to, say, solar or whatnot, but isn't it the imperative of the government when, for example, Carl Sagan was asked, you know, what was the value of the Apollo Project, and he said almost nothing. And yet, when you have something like alternative energy whereby the federal government can invest in it and create a situation where it's cheap off the shelf, yet they put in the money in the beginning to make it cheap off the shelf at the tail end for bettering our world.
Well, part of it is, for instance, the hydrogen-powered fuel cell automobile. And it's on a lot of people's lists, and a lot of manufacturers are showing, you know, slinky exteriors of automobiles ready for fuel cells. But right now, the platinum that goes into catalyzing the fuel cells is the order of $1 million a car. And I heard a lecture recently by a guy from Ballard, which is the leading manufacturer, and somebody asked about platinum. He says, oh, we think we can cut it down in half, $500,000. And I claim the great profit center in the hydrogen-powered car is going to be stealing automobiles. So I think there's some of these which no amount of well-intentioned engineering is going to get you something that you can use on a time scale that we need.
The B-1 bomber, it costs about I believe they costed it out. The weight of a B-1 bomber costs more than, you know, its weight in gold.
Well, look, I'm not claiming that money isn't being wasted. It is being wasted. But on the other hand, I think we need to have very good plans for what we want to do about the energy problem. It's too big to take little to take big risks with.
First of all, thank you. I enjoyed your talk. You mentioned Boeing earlier. About a year ago, I spoke with a David Oldland asking him about their not photovoltaic, but concentrated reflective solar stuff. And he flat out just wouldn't tell me what it actually cost by kilowatt hour. But he hinted that their cost might have been around 10 cents a kilowatt hour. I mean, it sounds cheaper than nuclear or some other things that you've mentioned. Perhaps your brother could, since he gave him that one book, ask him what their true cost is. I've also asked Sterling Energy Systems, which has got a lease for licensing on some of their patent technology for that.
Well, it is true that there are a lot of options, and we need to start with things where there's little uncertainty about whether they'll work. And then this next round of stuff. I think on the 15-year time scale, I'm not very scared. It's the 5-year time scale that makes me terrified.
Thank you. I was kind of curious what types of things might make you adjust your prediction for the 2005.
Oh, yes. Major thing would be new discoveries, field extensions, new oil, you know, being pumped into the system, being found for the system. That's not happening. And that, more than anything else, would change the picture. Now, the point of the Chevron ads is to say, come join us, let's open up all these areas for drilling. But they are not really showing that even if they were all opened up, profitable though it might be for the companies involved, the world wouldn't be very much closer to a solution. So I think we have to say safety is on the side of presuming that we're not going to have a sudden burst. I mean, the best thing that could happen would be the 6 countries around the South China Sea sit down and sign an agreement to divide the oil up some way, and we start exploring the South China Sea. It's been mostly natural gas around the edges, but that's the last major place on Earth that hasn't been explored.
One thing that made me wonder this was that Colin Campbell from the Association of the Study of Peak Oil and Gas recently moved his prediction from 2007 to 2010, and I was curious about that.
Campbell has split the thing up so that he talks about conventional oil, then he has another category of Arctic and a category of heavy oils and a category of, and he has to mess with each of those individually. And my thing is, look, if it'll go into a refinery, that's oil. So I'm not splitting it up. And I don't know what triggered Campbell's backing off. Unfortunately, he has a long history of it. He wrote one original paper for the newsletter of a Norwegian oil company that predicted a peak in 1995 or 1997, and he's kept moving back. And of course, all the economists are going, yeah, see? And that's what I'm holding forth steady, saying I don't see anything that makes me, what I just posted about the Thanksgiving thing on my website says, I don't see anything that makes me back off.
Good evening. You have people like Willie Nelson opening biodiesel stations. I mean, is that a future? I mean, what's going to happen with biodiesel? What do you see there?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of what's sold as biodiesel now is biodiesel 9, meaning it's 90% petroleum and 10% soybeans. And people drive around saying, see, I'm driving on biodiesel. Oh, come on. And there apparently is one filling station in Berkeley where you can buy 100% biodiesel. You pay quite a lot extra for it, but you feel good for having done it. Part of the problem is we got 6 billion mouths to feed, and that number is going up fast, and we may need all that bio to eat for lunch. And
so you don't see a future there?
I don't see how it's going to solve a major part of our problem. If you got a way of cutting the population back to 1 billion people real quick, then hey, we got some surplus farm production capacity. But nothing on the horizon gets us a large population drop.
Thank you.
Congratulations on a beautiful book. I'm Jamie Hecht from the Wilderness Publications. Since Hurricanes Rita and Katrina, a great deal of our capacity, not only for refining, but also for offshore drilling and for ship-to-shore and rig-to-shore transportation of both petroleum and natural gas has been wiped out, something like 130 rigs. Apparently, the reason why we haven't been plunged into a very serious recession is, on the one hand, our sudden willingness to deplete the strategic petroleum reserve of the United States, and on the other, an extraordinary flourish of generosity from the Europeans with their own strategic reserves. I'm wondering, what's your picture for this winter? Even if it's a mild one, perhaps those reserves, which were in the closet and have now been depleted, will run out and will hit a shock in the spring.
Geologists are notorious for looking back at the past and not at the future. So I don't have any more standing than any random person in the audience about this. Some of that stuff in the Gulf Coast is referred to as being shut in rather than permanently damaged. And now, I have been surprised it's taking them a while to get that stuff back up and running, so that something like 20% of the capacity of the offshore Gulf Coast is still offline. The U.S. economy has always been amazingly resilient, that bad things happen and, well, as a geologist, big storm tears up the New Jersey coast. By the time we get the next semester students out there, it's all repaired. And same with the Los Angeles earthquake damage of 10 years ago. By the time our next year's class visited, hey, you know, things were so repaired that it didn't look like a disaster area. And part of the worry is, at some point, do we pull the slack out of the system and we can't respond as nicely as we used to be able to do?
If I understood well your talk, we have two possible futures. One is a soft landing, and the second one is either a recession, either a massive die-off. Do you believe there will be some precursors telling us that we are heading towards the hard scenario?
Well, look, about the recession thing, I simply have no expertise as a geologist to understand or predict what's going on. If you want to know what I'm doing to protect myself, is buying resources trusts like Sabine Resources Trust and BPT, Prudhoe Bay Trust, oil and gas revenue streams from the royalty side, and they can't waste money drilling dry holes. So I've been trying to, and I bought some PetroChina stock, buy things that are denominated in oil instead of denominated in dollars, because I am nervous that the slack may come out of the system. And the kind of thing that people have been worried about is, what happens if they start selling oil in euros instead of dollars? Then we can't just print dollars and swap it for oil.
Was it Colin Campbell that came forward, that Heinberg speaks of, that in order to avert a hard landing, international cooperation to recognize basically where we are and form an international cooperative on how we're choosing to use the remaining resources? Obviously, in this country, our present leadership is not, although they're oil-oriented, they have a very kind of hard edge toward how they plan to approach this problem. Are you familiar with internationally what the global outlook is?
Well, of course, it's a global market, so I really care about the total global picture and not the United
States. Politically, I mean.
But I read Colin Campbell's monthly web posting every month. You know, it's very interesting. And a number of people tell me, until something sufficiently ghastly happens, convince everyone that, yes, there's a real problem, that nothing's going to be done internationally or nationally. And because I then say, you mean the World Trade Center wasn't bad enough? Well, that's part of the question then. Is it going to be something very much worse than the World Trade Center disaster that finally says, yes, look, it's here, we got to deal with it?
I wondered what you think about the idea of reducing consumption, especially, say, in transportation, passenger transportation. And, for example, if you look back to the year 1900, when there weren't any automobiles and everybody was traveling by railroad, the average person only traveled 1 mile per day by railroad. Today, it's about 50 miles per day on automobiles and airplanes. And if you could ever go back to what we had in 1900, that would be a 50-fold reduction in passenger transportation fuel.
I know we can't go back that far, but I mean, what do you think are the prospects for reducing consumption? Well, by reducing travel, for example.
In the travel reduction example, I give you one. A few weeks ago, I was up at Yale, and Professor and Mrs. Skinner, both distinguished scientists, have a lovely house about 40 minutes from the Yale campus. They have recently rented in an addition, an apartment, near the campus. So on weekends and holidays and summer, they live in their big, lovely house, but they sleep in the apartment during the week, and they got out from under the commute. So one at a time, people are starting to do things. It just hasn't become a mass movement yet. Although you talk about 1900, my mother claims, having grown up on a farm with a horse and buggy, she was born in 1903, that the automobile was enormously liberating. She was the first generation to go away to college, that you didn't have to marry somebody from the next farm, that the world opened up enormously with the automobile. So I don't think that we want to go back very far in terms of mobility. Now, you know, visiting through the internet is certainly one way that we can make connections and be global without having to pay for as much fuel as it took me to get here from New York.
A comment on that is that the world became much cleaner when the automobile first came in because you got rid of the horse droppings and horse urine. That was an enormous problem of disposal in the days of 1900.
For the last 3 years, I've been driving a Toyota RAV4 EV, and I have solar panels on my house that I bought for about $8,000 per kilowatt. And if I amortize the cost of those over their lifetime, it costs me about 50 cents per gallon equivalent to drive my car. Today, with nickel metal hydride batteries and even the better lithium ion batteries, you can build electric vehicles that travel over 300 miles on a charge. You can fast charge them in 5 minutes. And you can use off-peak power at 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour through most of the nation to charge these cars. The problem is getting the auto companies to build them because they're very stable, they don't break down, and much of the profit of the auto industry comes from parts and service. So what we need is a political leader who is willing to force this issue. The only reason I have my car is because California passed the zero emission vehicle mandate in 1990 and forced the auto companies to build them. They built 5,000, they took 4,000 back and crushed them until we stopped them from doing that. There are 1,000 of these vehicles left, and they're testament to the fact that this technology works, and it works today. I don't drive with any pollution, I drive with sunshine.
Well, wait a minute. You have, but you got your own solar cells.
Yes.
So you're not plugging it into the grid.
No, I plug into the grid. I charge during night when there's off-peak surplus power. My solar panels are
Yeah, but
feeding.
You're still polluting Arizona.
No.
When you plug that thing in Los Angeles.
Okay. All right, hold on, because this is an issue, and you need to hear the truth here. The truth is, my car will travel 3 miles on 1 kilowatt hour of power. If you take the amount of pollution that's generated to get that kilowatt hour into my battery and compare that to driving 3 miles with the cleanest gasoline hybrid, it is less pollution.
Okay.
And the fact that I'm generating power during the peak hours of the day, I'm offsetting very dirty coal plants during the day, and I charge at night with cleaner power. So don't believe it that electric cars are dirtier than gas cars. They are not.
Today I attended an energy meeting in downtown Los Angeles. One of the speakers spoke of an additional petroleum energy source, or actually two sources, albeit flawed. One, tar sands in northern Alberta. Two, shale with oil in the western U.S. How flawed do you think these sources are, and how substantial do you think they are?
In the case of the Alberta tar sands, they are currently close to being natural gas limited. They're heavy users of natural gas, and the NAFTA agreement requires the three countries in North America to observe their historic sales patterns so that Canada's obligated to sell gas to the U.S., the U.S. is obligated to sell gas to Mexico, as things run short, are the Canadians going to sit in the cold and the dark and continue to sell gas to the U.S.? No, you know, the NAFTA agreement comes unglued. So the situation with the tar sands is not just, you know, a wide open, here it is, take as much as you want. They're natural gas limited now. They can re-engineer their way around that. They are water, heavy water users. They use 3 barrels of water to get 1 barrel of oil. They can recycle some of the water, but the Canadian thing may be limited. And I have a chapter on tar sands and a chapter on oil shale in Beyond Oil. I think they were selling copies outside. The oil shale is a long ways from being successful right now. When you retort the oil shale, it fluffs up. You can't poke it back in the hole you mined it out of. You're going to have to commandeer a canyon somewhere and start filling it with spent shale. So it's not on the horizon right now. Shale's giving it another try, but there are several $1 billion worth of equipment rusting in the Colorado sunshine right now from the last oil shale.
Oh, so you briefly mentioned the futures market during your presentation. And currently on such markets, one can purchase a barrel of crude oil for the year, say, 2010 or 2011, which is actually cheaper than oil today. And I was wondering why you thought that might be the case.
Oh, I got no expertise on this. I gave a talk at Merrill Lynch, and at lunch afterwards, the people were saying to me, look, if you believe your story, you should be buying oil futures. So I said, no, you ought to be buying options on oil futures, because you can move a lot of money for a small amount put down. Well, I went to the bookstore and got a book on futures markets. And there are these things like the long bull straddle and the iron butterfly and the short strangle. And I said, wait a minute, this is a whole education that I don't have. And part of the limit was that there are some long-term oil futures contracts, but they're not options sold typically for much more than a couple of years. Well, on a couple of year time scale, those zigs and zags of price are going to dominate. So I backed off saying, look, the only thing I know about it is the long-term pattern. And so I need to be immune to the short-term things. And so I turned back to an old-fashioned buy and hold thing. You know, I bought Sabine and I'm not going to get off it until it starts to run out.
Yes. How high do you think the price of crude has to rise before it's economical to make gasoline out of coal?
I think we've been there. That technology is well known. It's the Fischer-Tropsch process. It dates from before World War II. And when the South Africans were cut off from world oil, they made gasoline from coal. And that plant's still operating, but it's making petrochemical feedstocks nowadays. But I think we're there.
When I was a kid growing up in the Third World, in other words, the U.S. Deep South, most of us had what was called town gas, which was made from coal. That was before the big pipelines brought natural gas to the Third World.
So I just want to engage you on the soft landing versus hard landing issue. If I understand correctly, we currently spend about 2 to 2.5% of world GNP on energy of all types. If that's true, then a large part of the problem, given all the externalities of energy, and oil in particular, is that energy is too cheap. That if the price of energy doubles, we'll start doing all sorts of things that are going to make all of our uses a lot more efficient. So in that sense, it seems to me that the Hubbert's Peak is a great blessing. If we increase the price of oil to over $100 a barrel, that's not really something the world economy can absorb, but that's going to lead to all sorts of productive changes in how the economy is organized.
Well, even if the U.S. can absorb, I'm worried about the farmer in Kenya who can't absorb much, that they're just barely making it right now. And try it as a third world farmer and see whether it's as much fun. And I suspect it is not, that people start starving to death if you squeeze too hard on the price of energy.
Right, but isn't it the price that's going to cause the changes that will
And this running battle with economists, they think price is everything, and I think supply and where do you get it and how easy is it to get it and can we find a more efficient way of using phosphate fertilizer? You know, I was a geological engineer as an undergraduate, and the only course I took in economics, I didn't understand. I didn't feel I had my hands around it, so I don't know. I mean, I don't have any expertise in that.
A few minutes ago, in answer to another question, a remark of yours slip by, and it was about the fact that you are more sanguine about what we'll have available to us in terms of new technologies maybe 10 to 15 years from now, but you're quite scared about what's happening in the next five. Could you be more vivid for us about the next five?
Well, see, there are several scenarios. If you look up Amos Neuer's website by typing Amos, N-U-R, Neuer on Google, and click on oil and war, you know, there's one view of what can happen in the short run. Another kind of argument, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but another argument says, why are we in Afghanistan of all the funny places? Because it has a border with China and a border with Iran. It's the sole barrier to the Chinese building a pipeline straight to the Middle East. I even looked up on maps.google at the boundary between Afghanistan and China. It's not that rough. I could get a pipeline through there in a long summer. So there are short-run hazards that we're not in very good control of. The 15-year time scale. Oh, but somebody mentioned earlier in a question, political leadership. I think we're desperately in need of another Winston Churchill or John Kennedy to stand up and say, look, this is a tough problem, but we're tough people, we're going to do it.
I was going to ask you about the political situation, since I don't think that either political party, which seems to be operating off of sound bites that you hear in the, you know, that you see on television by the talking heads, neither a political party seem to have the political will right now to do anything. The two things that you mentioned the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit to limit our use. You also mentioned using more nuclear generations. Those are, what, 10, 15 years down the pipeline. Other things like CAFE standards to limit the consumption of gasoline as opposed to the big SUVs and that kind of thing.
Well,
I don't see the political will by anybody.
Oh, no, you're quite correct. And Senator Kerry, had he been elected, might have represented as difficult an education problem as President Bush, because Kerry would say in his standard campaign speech, we don't want to be beholden to the Saudi royal family. We want to be energy independent. Big applause. Then his staff would say, sir, you can't deliver on that. And the other half of the staff said, so what? It gets a big applause, leave it in. Well, had Kerry been elected, we'd have had the same education problem.
Right. I mean, nothing would be different from the energy.
You know, the one exception is Representative Roscoe Bartlett from Maryland, who's been giving speeches, running meetings, trying to get the story out, and he's as frustrated as the rest of us. That.
What do you think would have to happen to get the public's attention?
I have trouble thinking of something worse than the World Trade Center, and I don't want to think of something worse than the World Trade Center. So.
You mean like continuous $72 a barrel oil?
Well, I said in one of the books, when I drive my pickup into the filling station and it costs $100 to fill it up, you know, nuclear is not as scary as it used to be. You got my attention. But something like that, that there's some trigger, and to me it's $100 to fill up the tank of the pickup. And I don't drive that much. It really wouldn't hurt me because, you know, I make trips to the grocery store, but I live two blocks from the campus. Yeah, I can walk to the grocery store. I don't really need that truck very much. But
you should buy $200 to an RV.
Right. That paying $100 at the filling station would really catch me where it hurts.
Why did you choose not to use logarithmic charts? And the reason I ask that, the charts you use are emotionally stimulating but factually misleading.
Well, you can take it any way you want. However, the numbers are from the end of year production numbers from Oil and Gas Journal, and I tell you what I do. It's P over Q versus Q. Here's the graph. Now, if you want to do it some other way, you're welcome to do it some other way.
I don't have the audience. You do. The world is about percentages. It's not about 1, 2, 3, 4. Change takes place in relationship to the real world, and it's in percentages, and those charts are misleading.
a bell-shaped logistic comes out a straight line on that graph, and if you're trying to predict the future, a straight line is your mother's comfort food. So I like it because it gives me a straight line and, you know, a straightforward way to interpret it.
It seems to me, since I was a teenager in the 30s, when I first heard of the word fusion, I've been reading about it ever since. Do you think there's any chance there'll be a breakthrough on fusion?
The first experimental work began at Princeton, and they declassified it in 1958, and we all went through and toured it and said, isn't this wonderful? Well, 1958 to today, you know, it's been a while, and they keep saying, well, we're getting closer. But what I say in the Beyond Oil book is I asked them some years ago, well, what about a hybrid fusion fission thing? Because fission reactors, uranium reactors, habitually starve for neutrons, and fusion reactors are very neutron rich. Ha, let's get together. Most nuclear weapons, in fact, are hybrids. How about a hybrid? How far would you have to go to meet the threshold for a hybrid fusion fission reactor? Oh, we passed that 5 years ago. And so, hey, they're ready, but they don't want to hear about it because their thing is going to be clean and not produce, you know, dirty radioactive wastes. So I think the hybrid could be implemented, but they got no interest in it. And, you know, we've waited patiently for almost 50 years, and patience is beginning to run a little thin. It's not something I can bet on for the 5-year timescale.
I have to thank the audience for a bunch of very perceptive questions. I think the speaker would be willing to talk to a few of you down front now. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to The Peak of World Oil Production, Thanksgiving Day, 2005, the title of the Lauritsen Memorial Lecture given by Professor Ken DeFeis. The talk was given at the California Institute of Technology on December 1st of 2005. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.